Yes, good morning. My name is Maureen Sear. I represent Scotty Miller, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes for rebuttal.
In this case, the trial court abused its discretion in admitting several highly prejudicial out-of-court statements made by the decedent expressing her fear of Mr. Miller and describing his supposed threatening behaviors. Those statements were not admissible because, as in most murder prosecutions, the decedent's state of mind was not relevant in this case, and therefore her out-of-court statements describing her state of mind were not admissible. Admission of the statements was unfairly prejudicial and impacted Mr. Miller's right to a fair trial because he had no opportunity to cross-examine Ms. Patricelli about her statements. Therefore, this court must reverse the conviction. In addition, the exceptional sentence must be reversed for several reasons, including that the trial court relied upon Mr. Miller's criminal history in imposing an exceptional sentence, which was already taken into account by the legislature in establishing the standard range. The jury instruction on one of the aggravators was an unconstitutional comment on the evidence, and one of the aggravators was also unconstitutionally vague. There are several issues in this case, and I would like to focus on the evidentiary issue and then move to the exceptional sentence if there's time. Again, as I stated, it is well settled and a long-standing rule that in a murder prosecution, the decedent's state of mind is not relevant, and therefore the decedent's out-of-court statements expressing her state of mind are not admissible, in part and largely because the admission of such statements, those statements tend to be inflammatory, highly prejudicial, and unfair because the defendant does not have an opportunity to cross-examine the decedent. The decedent's out-of-court statements expressing her state of mind are generally admissible only if the decedent's state of mind is specifically put at issue by the specific defense raised, such as in a case of self-defense or a case of accident, or in a case such as Ethan, where the defendant claimed that the decedent had consensual sex with him, and her out-of-court statements expressing her dislike of him were deemed to be relevant and admissible to rebut that specific claim.
Didn't Mr. Miller say at some point, though, that she was attacking him or that she was surprised him in some way?
He did claim that they had an argument, and she, I think he said she shoved him or something like that, but he's not claiming self-defense. This is not a self-defense defense. He's not specifically claiming that she acted in a way that would require her out-of-court statements regarding her fear of him to be admissible. And also keep in mind that even if her state of mind were somehow admissible, her statements describing his behavior, which caused her state of mind, so in other words, the trial court admitted several statements where she not only expressed fear of him, but also described his threatening behaviors. Those would not be admissible, even if somehow her state of mind were relevant.
Assuming that's true, given the other evidence, specifically the text messages, how was this evidence prejudicial?
Well, her out-of-court statements, her descriptions of him.
No, I'm talking about the conduct. I mean, assuming that the statements related to conduct were inadmissible, following up on what you've just said, how was that prejudicial given the significant text message evidence that the jury had?
Well, I think any statement by the decedent, who is deemed to be the victim here, I mean, any statements by her would be especially persuasive, I think, to the jury and would have an especial harmful impact on the jury. Simply because she is the victim. And Mr. Miller did not have an opportunity to cross-examine her about the statements.
You've made that point. So your position is whether the statement related to conduct or state of mind, because it was from the victim, it's prejudicial without regard to any other evidence.
Well, in judging the whether an evidentiary error requires reversal, the court, of course, does have to look at whether the other evidence was overwhelming. But as Washington Supreme Court clearly stated in State v. Parr, these kind of statements are highly prejudicial. They're very unfair, and they're not admissible. And I think in this case, regardless of the other evidence, that those statements were unfairly prejudicial and probably had an undue impact, harmful impact on the jury.
We understand the challenges you've made to the exceptional sentence, and you've mentioned the main arguments that you've made today. But what about the court's reliance on rapid recidivism? What is the error there?
Well, our argument is that the evidence is simply insufficient to support that aggravator beyond a reasonable doubt. In general, the courts have upheld that the jury finding regarding that aggravator when the defendant committed a crime within hours of release from incarceration. Here it was at least 2 weeks, and our position is that's not a sufficient period of time beyond a reasonable doubt.
So you're arguing that rapid recidivism must occur within hours based on the case law?
Within hours or sometime less than the amount of time that passed in this case.
And what case are you relying on for that?
Butler and Cham are the two cases where the courts upheld the rapid recidivism aggravator where the defendant committed the crime within hours of release. But even if this court were to uphold that aggravator and strike the other aggravator, the exceptional sentence must still be reversed. Regardless of the trial court's boilerplate finding, I don't think that this record supports a conclusion that the court would have imposed the same exceptional sentence if only that one aggravator had been found.
But that's what the court's order says.
It's, again, the court imposed an exceptional sentence that was more than 10 years above the standard, the high end of the standard range. A court's sentence must be based on principled discretion. That most of the emphasis and the discussion, the evidence, was focused on the other aggravator, and I don't think that it's clear, regardless of that boilerplate finding, which again is simply a boilerplate finding, that the court would have imposed the same sentence.
Thank you. Yes, for rebuttal. Before we hear from respondent, we have a number of people seated in back. Could the folks here in the courtroom make room so people could come in and have a seat? We appreciate it.
Good morning, Your Honors. Amy Methling, appearing on behalf of the State of Washington, the respondent in this matter. With respect to the evidentiary issues, first, the defendant in his reply brief argued that the evidence of the victim's state of mind becomes relevant and admissible if it tends to show the victim would not have acted in the way claimed by the defense. And that's from his reply brief, and that's why the evidence of her fear was admitted here. He admitted to intentionally killing his ex-girlfriend. The only issue that was contested was premeditation, whether he did this as the state argued that he entered her apartment knowing she was gone, laid in wait underneath her bed, and then surprised her when she came home and stabbed her to death, or whether he came to take a shower while she was gone, thinking that she wouldn't come home and that she came home and surprised him. They argued, she pushed him out of the way, called him names and threatened him, and he killed her in a fit of rage. So that's why the evidence of her fear was admissible. And with respect to the prejudicial effect of this testimony, counsel refers to the highly prejudicial effect of these statements, but I'd like to talk about what the statements really were. The only, really prejudicial statement that she made was that she was afraid of him to her coworker, where she said, I'd like you to walk me home after work and walk through my house because I'm afraid he might be hiding in there and I'm scared of him. That's probably the most prejudicial thing that the court allowed in. The other things related to how she felt when knowing he was coming home from prison, that she was a little bit nervous and relieved. I fail to see the prejudicial impact of that. The statement that she was afraid of him when he climbed the balcony to enter her apartment and assault her in December of the previous year, which was the reason why he went to prison in the first place. The court independently admitted that evidence of that incident, his behavior, the climbing of the wall, that all came in as 404B. That was properly admitted, and that's not challenged here today. So those are the actual statements that we're talking about. her statement to her friend that I think he's lurking around outside somewhere, and I'm, you know, and then she goes and locks the windows the night before he killed her. While prejudicial, perhaps in a vacuum, the evidence was uncontested that he was, in fact, lurking around outside and in hiding in her closet on her balcony. He admitted that to himself in his testimony. So, again, I fail to see how that's particularly prejudicial. And with respect to the text message about her, they have this back and forth the night before where he's describing, or she's describing his behavior as threatening and stalking and harassing. The defendant admitted into evidence himself in his own case in chief another text message that the state did not introduce, an exchange between the victim and the defendant the night before, where she is belittling him, essentially calling him a bitch and telling him that his private parts were small. He chose to admit that text message, including the part of it where she says to him, call someone else names, be with someone else, stalk someone else. You're not going to sit here and verbally abuse me. I've been too good to you and the only one down for you, so think what you want. So she characterizes his behavior in that text message as stalking as well, and he admitted that into evidence himself. So when you're considering the prejudicial effect of these statements, which were, I believe, properly admitted, I think you have to consider the entire context of what the defendant himself wanted in, because he clearly thought that that exchange was relevant to her state of, his state of mind, what she had said to him and that, how that angered him. I'd like to talk just briefly about the sentencing aggravators with respect to the ongoing pattern of abuse. I just want to be clear that the court was not relying on the fact that the defendant had criminal history when it imposed an exceptional sentence. That was not the basis for the exceptional sentence. The only fact...
Were all the priors admitted for the jury?
Yes. So the only fact that the court relied on was the fact that the jury found an ongoing pattern, that the crime constituted part of an ongoing pattern of abuse over a prolonged period of time. That's the only fact that the court relied on. Now, the convictions came in and were admitted to the jury in their consideration of that question, but it wasn't the fact of the conviction alone, which is what the case law is pretty clear, that you can't take something that the legislature has already considered when establishing the standard range. You can't consider just the fact of the conviction, because that's all that's relevant to calculate an offender score, is does he have felony convictions and how many. Here, the jury considered the nature of those convictions as it pertained to the question of whether this murder constituted an ongoing pattern of abuse. Now, whether the jury actually relied on those convictions, probably, in part. There was lots of other evidence admitted, including evidence about from his ex-wife, who was not the victim of this murder. Her family came in and her neighbor and discussed serious abuse over a prolonged period of time of her. So we don't really know what the jury relied on in coming to that factual conclusion of the aggravator. So, and that's the only thing that the court relied on, was that factual finding. So,
well, if that were to be the case, why would you even admit the priors in the penalty phase? Why wouldn't you have the people just describe the events?
Well, we don't always have the people, number one. We did have some of them here. But it's not, I'm not trying to insinuate that the jury can't rely on those convictions. Then it's the nature of those convictions that becomes relevant as it pertains to the question that they're asked to determine. It's not the simple fact of the conviction alone, which is the only thing that increases his sentencing range. And I also want to just talk about the rapid recidivism aggravating factor that the court alternatively relied on. And I want to just respond to the court's question a moment ago about whether the court would have imposed the same sentence based on either one of the aggravators. And what Judge Lindy stated when she imposed the sentence was that, I've been around a long time. I've seen a lot of cases. I've sentenced a lot of offenders. I have not seen this kind of intentional, systematic, repetitive devotion to terrorizing women. Those aggravating factors which the jury found for purposes of sentencing really compel absolutely no other conclusion here in this court's opinion, that 600 months is the appropriate sentence. The defendant was incarcerated for threatening to kill Tricia Patricelli in May of 2012. He was released on October 15 of 2012. In the time that he was released, he told his mother he was going to kill her. He told a friend he was going to kill her. He told her he was going to kill her. He told the world on Facebook that he had planned to go back to prison for harming her, and then he killed her by stabbing her 30 times. I don't know how the court's finding of, or the jury's finding that the offense was committed shortly after the defendant's release could be any more compelling a reason for the court to impose an exceptional sentence in this case.
Well, the other argument is that the court erred in imposing the exceptional sentence based on rapid recidivism because it didn't happen within hours or a short period of time. Right. What's your response to that?
Well, defense seems to be arguing that 15 days as a matter of law is right. too long a period of time, and the courts have refused essentially to set an outer limit on what could constitute a short period of time. In fact, the other argument the defendant makes in his brief with respect to the other aggravator is that this definition of the jury of a prolonged period of time is a comment on the evidence and cites to the court's decision in Brush. The court's decision in Brush makes pretty clear that telling the jury what constitutes a prolonged period of time is improper because that's strictly within the jury's role as a fact finder. So I know that these aggravators are somewhat different.
Yeah, they are different. So now you're mixing. So is there case law that you are relying on for your position as to rapid recidivism?
Yeah, I think that the cases that I cited in my brief with respect to the aggravator make pretty clear. Combs make fairly clear that we do not set an outer limit on what constitutes a short period of time, and that it varies in the circumstances. And I think, as I just, for the reasons that I just indicated, I don't think that there's any question that the defendant's rapid recidivism in this case is a substantial and compelling reason. And I think that she's mixing up the argument to some degree because it's the factual finding that the jury makes. All they're asked to determine is whether the crime occurred a short period of time after the defendant's release. And then the court is required legally to make a legal conclusion as to whether that constitutes a substantial and compelling reason. And I think those things are somewhat fudged in the briefing, but they are distinct. So I'd ask the court to affirm both the conviction and the sentence in this matter.
You have 3 minutes.
Pardon?
You have 3 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
What's your response to the 404B argument?
That
the conduct is admissible as 404B evidence.
Well, the other person's descriptions of his conduct were admissible because those were not hearsay. But here we're talking about hearsay. And the decedent's out-of-court statements were improperly admitted because they're hearsay, and they don't fall under the hearsay exception for state of mind because her state of mind was not relevant. The state's argument that Mr. Miller himself brought in the text message in which she was denigrating him, et cetera, and they were having a fight over the text message in the days leading up to the event, just demonstrates that her out-of-court statements were not necessary. And they're highly prejudicial, and not only were her statements made around the time of the event, but her statements made years previously. And I think those were very prejudicial. Her statement to the police officer who responded to one of the 2011 incidents when she said, please don't tell him I called, you don't know who you're dealing with. I mean, that is extremely inflammatory. And because, again, it came out of her mouth where he did not have an opportunity to cross-examine her. And she, of course, is the sympathetic person in this scenario. It must have had an undue impact on the jury. And I think the state's comments about the trial court's comments at sentencing just demonstrate again that I think the trial court heavily relied on the fact that there were all these prior incidents of abuse in imposing the exceptional sentence. The court made little or no comment at all regarding the rapid recidivism factor. I think that record shows clearly that she placed undue emphasis on that aggravating factor, and therefore, if that aggravating factor is vacated, the sentence must be reversed for resentencing. And the law is that the court may not impose an exceptional sentence based on prior offenses that led to criminal convictions. This is criminal history. The jury the evidence presented was evidence of criminal history. The court relied on those prior offenses, which, again, most of them did result in convictions. Mr. Miller was already punished for those previously, again punished when they were considered in calculating the offender score, and the law does not permit the court to impose an exceptional sentence based on those kinds of prior incidents that, again, he was already convicted and punished for. So for those reasons and the reasons in the briefing, we ask that the conviction and the exceptional sentence be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you.